Now's your chance to get the last of the Resolution Radio Blood Tees. Only a few left available before we try to do a reorder. This has been a high-selling item, and we really appreciate everyone's support in getting this shirt and showing their pride as well as showing their heritage. Nothing counts more than blood. Get yours today from Resolution Radio. Only $25 plus $5 shipping and handling. It really helps the network improve, and you really get a great product to showcase what you truly believe in. Nothing counts more than blood. Only from Resolution Radio at resolutionrdo.com. Send check, money order, or well-concealed cash to Sonny Thomas at P.O. Box 27, Springboro, Ohio, 45066. That's Sonny Thomas at P.O. Box 27, Springboro, Ohio, 45066. You're listening to Resolution Radio. ResolutionRDO.com.
Welcome to American Dissident Voices. I'm Kevin Alfred Strom. This week, I will begin a three-part series in honor of the great German leader and leader of our race, Adolf Hitler. In 1 week, it will be the 135th anniversary of his birth. Hitler's great philosophical and spiritual work was continued and expanded by William Luther Pierce, the National Alliance, and the Cosmotheist Church. This series will consist of updated versions of our best works on this topic, of all topics. Today we begin with the mythopoeic power of the hero. Let me also remind you that you can get the very best education on National Socialism, Adolf Hitler, and the epic struggle of an awakened Europe against the Jewish dagger aimed at our hearts by reading the works we have made available at Cosmotheist Books. From the very best translation of Hitler's Mein Kampf, the all-new work of scholar Thomas Dalton, to works on Hitler and National Socialism by L. Craig Fraser, Savitri Devi, Hans Schmidt, Martin Kerr, Alfred Rosenberg, Ernst Heimer, Joseph Goebbels, William Pierce, and others, and also including a massive and growing series of volumes written or published by Dr. Dalton, including The International Jew, The Protocols of the Elders of Zion, The Steep Climb, The Riddle of the Jew's Success, Eternal Strangers, and many, many more. They're all available for you. And there are very few subjects more important than this one. At our bookstore at cosmotheistchurch.org. That's cosmotheistchurch, all one word, .org. And now, the mythopoeic power of the hero. Listen. Adolf Hitler, what passion his name incites, among his people, among his enemies, who we now know to be our enemies also, among those who totally misunderstand him, among those who intellectually understand him, and among those who deeply, emotionally, and viscerally understand him. We once had a talented volunteer editor who quit helping us, in part, because National Vanguard was too pro-Hitler. He told me that he winced every time we talked about Hitler in a positive way. And one of our more prolific commenters on National Vanguard went further in a recent comment of his, quote, "Actions speak louder than words, and Hitler attacked and demeaned members of his own race, as a German chauvinist who just wrote of Pan-Aryanism while looking away at Jewish blood possibly flowing in himself and others running the Reich. Bombing England and torpedoing her colonial cargo ships come to mind first. But how did he sidestep the fact that pure Aryans existed in Russia and Poland, whose soldiers he starved when taken prisoner? There is no need for Hitler references except to point out political correctnesses, erroneous attributions to him. Hitler led Germany to ruin. Close quote. I have to stop there and say that there is no credible evidence that Adolf Hitler had Jewish ancestry. That's just another slander devised by Jewish propagandists to demoralize good people, people for whom Jewish ancestry in a white leader is a negative thing. But were there part Jews who were allowed to be in some responsible positions in the Third Reich's military establishment? Yes, there were, though not at the highest level. But at a middle level, yes, it happened. In retrospect, this can be seen as excessively tolerant and a mistake. Perhaps it's this kind of occasional softness toward apparently loyal part Jews on the part of the German National Socialists that inspired the meme I first saw almost 40 years ago, and which still survives today, in which we see an image of Hitler with the words, "Next time, no more Mr. Nice Guy." I'll merely mention, since they are so well known, Hitler's high regard for Great Britain and extreme disinclination to fight a war with her, and the great efforts he made to preserve peace with her. As for Pan-Aryanism, Hitler's change in attitude from his earlier disparagement of Slavs and his focus on Germans only has been well chronicled in James Harting's excellent article, Hitler and the Slavs in Historical Perspective, which you can read on National Vanguard. In it, he says in part, quote, "Contemporary National Socialists view Adolf Hitler as the symbolic leader of the whole of the Aryan race. I personally believe that this conception of Hitler is correct, and I embrace it enthusiastically. In Mein Kampf and elsewhere, Hitler spoke repeatedly about the fundamental transnational unity of the Aryan race, and specifically about the pan-Aryan nature of the struggle against international Jewry. Increasingly, as the war went on, Hitler found himself as the de facto head of all of the Aryan peoples of Europe, and not just of the Germans or of the Germanics. Indeed, from the historical perspective that we now enjoy, we can see that despite being at war with Great Britain, it was Hitler who had the best long-term interests of the British people at heart, and not the drunken Jewish cat's paw, Winston Churchill, who proved to be the true gravedigger of the British Empire. By the end of the war, Hitler had come to realize that his historical role had expanded far beyond that of simply being the Chancellor of the German Reich. In his Political Testament, written immediately before his death, he spoke of himself in the role of the defender of the European children of the Aryan nations. Close quote. In Ukraine and in Russia, and throughout much of Eastern Europe, Hitler's Germany was able not only to garner support, but to raise actual armies to fight for National Socialism's new order, despite whatever historical conflicts had existed previously between Slavic and Germanic peoples, and despite the fact that those conflicts left more than a trace in Hitler's early thinking, and in Mein Kampf itself. And despite the fact that a war was on, with all the near inevitable cruelties on both sides that implies, and despite even the fact that some of Hitler's subordinates still evidently harbored and acted on anti-Slavic sentiments. That seems almost incredible, but it is true. I believe it is an example of the mythopoeic power at work. The mythopoeic power of Hitler's and Germany's titanic struggle against the forces of evil. Evil that Eastern Europeans knew only too well. And I further believe that mythopoeic power is still alive and growing, and that we can and must harness it as part of our efforts to awaken, inspire, and organize our people. Germany's and Hitler's unparalleled efforts for our race and their ultimate immolation and sacrifice for that sacred cause are the stuff of which myths and legends are made, the stuff of which new faiths are made, faiths that can inspire men to great and heroic deeds, not just for the duration of a war, not just for a single lifetime, but for millennia. I believe this mythopoeic power, along with the deep insights of cosmotheism, can combine to bring into being a spiritual revolution in the hearts and minds of our people, exactly what is needed so that we will be able to do what must be done. There is available online a very good film, miniseries, really, it is many hours long, chronicling the life and world historical struggle of Adolf Hitler. It is entitled The Greatest Story Never Told. It is close to being objective, and cold-hearted indeed is the man or woman who can see it without first weeping, then rising in spirit to inspired action. And you don't need to watch any film to know that the opposite of the sick world in which we find ourselves is Hitler and all he stood for. Everyone knows that. Everyone from the plumber to the professor to the paperboy on the corner knows that the opposite of the sick gender bending to which we are required to pay obeisance is Hitler and all he stood for. The opposite of open borders and flooding our nation with invaders is Hitler and all he stood for. The opposite of the weakness displayed by the effeminate weaklings who are the poor excuses for men that we see everywhere these days is Hitler and all he stood for. The opposite of surrender to demographic death is Hitler and all he stood for. The opposite of illegals stealing your dad's job is Hitler and all he stood for. The opposite of greedy capitalists offshoring or H-1B-ing your livelihood away is Hitler and all he stood for. The opposite of white girls getting used or raped by non-white males is Hitler and all he stood for. Everyone already knows this. Many who know it also believe some of the Jewish falsehoods about Hitler, and those people need guidance. But they know who rose up to oppose all these metastasizing evils. And increasingly, among the young, they are beginning to wonder if that evil man, Hitler, was really so evil after all. Something of the spiritual essence of the final earthly days of the man to whom Yaqui simply referred as the hero of the Second World War comes through in this extract from Savitri Devi. Quote, "Calmer now, amid the thunder of explosions and the noise of crumbling buildings, the flames and ruins of the Second World War, then at the top of the Freienberg, under the stars, freed from the temporary wild despair that had seized him at the news of the Russian advance west of the Oder River, Adolf Hitler beheld the future. And that future, his own and that of National Socialism and that of Germany, which had now become forever the fortress of the new faith, was nothing less than eternity. The eternity of truth, more unshakable and more soothing in its majesty, even than that of the Milky Way. In spite of all, National Socialism, the modern expression of cosmic truth, would endure and conquer. National Socialism would rise again because it is true to cosmic reality and because that which is true does not pass. Germany's Via Dolorosa was indeed the way to coming glory. It had to be taken if the privileged nation was to fulfill her mission absolutely. That is, if she was to be the nation that died for the sake of the highest human race which she embodied, and that would rise again to take the lead of those surviving Aryans who are, at last, to understand her message of life and to carry it with them into the splendor of the dawning golden age." Close quote. As I said in my series, A New Religion for Us, from the life of Siddhartha Gautama to the beginnings of modern organized Buddhism, centuries passed. 300 years elapsed between the first stories of Jesus and the founding of Christianity. From the Mycenaean origins of the Eleusinian mysteries to the Greek celebration of them, there passed nearly 1,000 years. Adolf Hitler died just 11 years before I was born. We are just at the beginning. Mythopoeia is that which makes legends. Tolkien's great world-spinning works of fantasy are called mythopoeic. Tolkien himself wrote of the power of legendary figures in the lives and hearts of men, in a poem he once wrote, and I quote, "Blessed are the legend makers with their rhyme of things not found within recorded time. Such isles they saw afar, and ones more fair, and those that hear them yet may yet beware. They have seen death and ultimate defeat, and yet they would not in despair retreat, but oft to victory have tuned the lyre and kindled hearts with legendary fire." Close quote. Mythopoeia is not limited to fiction. I say that the isles they saw afar are the new world we will build, a world fit for Aryan man and Aryan woman to inhabit. And we all know who it was who saw death and ultimate defeat fate, and who nevertheless would not in despair retreat. And we also know who it is who must now to victory tune our lyres and kindle hearts with legendary fire.
You're listening to Resolution Radio. 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 ResolutionRDO.com. You're listening to Resolution Radio. 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 ResolutionRDO.com.
Welcome to American Dissident Voices. I'm Kevin Alfred Strom. On today's program, I'm going to present something very special. When the racial patriot and scientist William Shockley invented the transistor more than half a century ago, bringing the entire electronics and computer industries into existence, he set in motion a series of great advances that no one could have anticipated at the time. One of those advances is the ability with artificial intelligence to awaken the tongues of men long dead and allow them to speak in their own voices the words they wrote for posterity. Of course, this advance can be used for evil and to deceive, as the proliferation of deep fakes on social media proves. But we use it today for good, to bring the voice of Dr. William Luther Pierce to life, with his very own words, on a topic he regarded as one of the most important of all time, the life and works of Adolf Hitler. So now, an entirely new audio presentation of William Luther Pierce's The Measure of Greatness. Listen.
April 20 is the anniversary of the birth of the greatest man of our era, a man who dared more and achieved more, who set his aim higher and climbed higher, who felt more deeply and stirred the souls of those around him more mightily, who was more closely attuned to the life force which permeates our cosmos and gives it meaning and purpose, and did more to serve that life force than any other man of our times. And yet he is the most reviled and hated man of our times. Only a few tens of thousands of men and women in scattered groups around the world will celebrate his birthday with love and reverence on April 20th, while all of the scribblers and commentators of the controlled news media, the controlled politicians, and the controlled churchmen will pour out their hatred and venom and lies against him, and those lies will be believed by hundreds of millions. What is the measure of greatness in a man? Only the most vulgar and doctrinaire Democrat would seriously equate greatness with popularity, although in any polling of average citizens on their choice for the greatest man of the century, there are certain to be substantial numbers of votes for Elvis Presley, John Kennedy, Billy Graham, Michael Jackson, and various other high-visibility lightweights, charismatic entertainers on the stage of politics, rock concerts, spectator sports, or what have you. More serious citizens would pass by the lightweights and choose men who have changed the world in some way. We would hear choices like Franklin Roosevelt, he saved the world from fascism, Albert Einstein, he taught us about the nature of our universe, and Martin Luther King, he helped us achieve racial justice. Depending upon whether one's personal inclinations lay more in the direction of politics, science, or racial self-abasement, respectively. But if the poll asked instead for for the most evil man of the century, or the most hated man, or the man having the most negative influence, at least three-quarters of the blue-collar and the white-collar polies alike would name one man, Adolf Hitler. This, however, would be merely a reflection of the role assigned to him by the controlled mass media, rather than a truly informed and reasoned choice. All of this raises several very interesting issues. There is, for example, the question of how we came to the preposterous state of affairs prevailing today, wherein we place the destiny of our nation, our planet, and our race in the hands of a mass of voters whose powers of judgment are manifested in such things as the type of television entertainment their preferences have pushed into prime time and the type of men they have elected to public office. And there is the equally weighty question of how, knowing the ease with which this mass is misled, we permitted virtually all of the media of mass information and entertainment to fall into the hands of a race whose interests are so diametrically opposed to our own. Perhaps even more pertinent to a consideration of human greatness, however, is the question of how our system of values came to be turned on its head so that Franklin Roosevelt is regarded as a hero and Adolf Hitler as a villain, not only by the stolid and stunned masses, but also by a majority of the supposedly educated elite, many of whom pride themselves on their intellectual independence. Whether we judge the greatness of a man by his intrinsic qualities of character and soul, or by his accomplishments, Adolf Hitler had greatness of a very high order, if we use the standards which have been traditional in our race. We cannot, of course, make comparisons with all the mute, inglorious Miltons, whose lack of notable accomplishment has made them anonymous, despite the sterling inner qualities they may have possessed. But when Hitler's character is held up beside those of other 20th century political leaders, he stands as a giant among pygmies. At the prosaic level, we can note his ascetic personal habits compared with Winston Churchill's habitual drunkenness and notorious self-indulgence, or his personal loyalty to those who had been his comrades in the days of political struggle compared with Joseph Stalin's habit of murdering his former comrades by the dozen as potential rivals as soon as he no longer needed their services, or his direct, frank, and straightforward manner compared to the cunning deviousness which was Franklin Roosevelt's trademark. At the spiritual level, the inner differences between Hitler and his contemporaries are even more striking. Hitler was a man with a mission from the beginning. The testimony of his closest associates from his boyhood days to the end of his life agrees with the observations of more distant and impartial observers. Hitler had a mystical sense of destiny, a sense of having been singled out and called by a higher power to devote his life to the service of his race. His childhood companion, August Kubizek, has related extraordinary evidence of this when Hitler was only 16 years old. 20 years later, while he was in prison after an unsuccessful attempt to overthrow the government, Hitler himself wrote of his motivation in a way which suggested the range of his vision. Quote, "What we must fight for is the security of the existence and reproduction of our race and our people, the sustenance of our children and the maintenance of the purity of our blood, so that our people may mature for the fulfillment of the mission allotted them by the Creator of the universe." Every thought and every idea, every doctrine and all knowledge must serve this purpose, and everything must be examined from this point of view and used or rejected according to its utility. Then no theory will stiffen into a dead doctrine, since it is life alone that all things must serve. The National Socialist philosophy finds the importance of mankind in its basic racial elements. In the state, it sees on principle a means to an end and construes that end as the preservation of the racial existence of man. And so the National Socialist philosophy of life corresponds to the innermost will of nature, since it restores that free play of forces which must lead to a continuous mutual higher breeding until finally the best of humanity, having achieved possession of this earth, will have a free play for activity in domains which will lie partly above it and partly outside it. We all sense that in the distant future, humanity must be faced by problems which only a highest race, become master people and supported by the means and possibilities of an entire globe, will be equipped to overcome. Thus, the highest purpose of a national socialist state is concern for the preservation of those original racial elements which bestow culture and create the beauty and dignity of a higher mankind. We, as Aryans, can conceive of the state only as the living organism of a nationality, which not only assures the preservation of this nationality, but by the development of its spiritual and ideal abilities, leads it to the highest freedom. A national socialist state must begin by raising marriage from the level of a continuous defilement of the race and give it the consecration of an institution which is called upon to produce images of the Lord and not monstrosities halfway between man and ape. It must set race in the center of all life. It must take care to keep it pure. It must declare the child to be the most precious treasure of the people. It must see to it that only the healthy beget children. The National Socialist State must make certain that by a suitable education of youth, it will someday obtain a race ripe for the last and greatest decisions on this earth. Anyone who wants to cure this era, which is inwardly sick and rotten, must first summon the courage to make clear the causes of this disease. And this should be the concern of the National Socialist Movement, pushing aside all narrow-mindedness, to gather and to organize from the ranks of our nation those forces capable of becoming the vanguard fighters for a new philosophy of life. We are not simple enough to believe that it could ever be possible to bring about a perfect era. But this relieves no one of the obligation to combat recognized errors, to overcome weaknesses, and to strive for the ideal. Harsh reality of its own accord will create only too many limitations. For that very reason, however, man must try to serve the ultimate goal, and failures must not deter him any more than he can abandon a system of justice because mistakes creep into it, or any more than medicine is discarded because there always will be sickness in spite of it. We National Socialists know that with this conception, we stand as revolutionaries in the world of today and are branded as such. But our thoughts and actions must in no way be determined by the approval or disapproval of our time, but by the binding obligation to a truth which we have recognized. End quote. Hitler's opponents, Churchill and Roosevelt, were party politicians with the minds and souls of party politicians. Great impersonal goals, just as truth, meant nothing at all to them. The only thing that counted was the approval or disapproval of their times. The outcome of the next election, a good press claque, votes. Only Stalin shared in any way Hitler's disdain for approval. Only Stalin was motivated to any degree by an impersonal idea. But the idea that Stalin served was the alien, destructive idea of Jewish Marxism. And while Hitler served the life force with the instincts of a seer, Stalin served Marxism with the instincts of a bureaucrat and a butcher. A comparison of careers leads us to a similar ranking of greatness of soul. Churchill and Roosevelt were born into the political establishment. They fed at the public trough for years, in one office after another, grabbing greedily at opportunities for a bigger serving of swill. But it was circumstance, not their own efforts, which thrust them onto the stage of world history. Stalin hacked out his own niche in history to a much greater extent than his Western allies, and he was an incomparably stronger man than either of them. He was tough, ruthless, infinitely cunning, and utterly determined to prevail, no matter what the obstacles. Even so, His struggle for prominence and power was entirely within the Bolshevik Party and its predecessors. He was the consummate bureaucratic infighter, not the innovator or the lone pioneer. Only Adolf Hitler started literally from nothing, and through the exercise of a superhuman will, created the physical basis for the realization of his vision. In 1918, recovering in a veterans' hospital from a British poison gas attack, he made the decision to enter politics in order to serve that vision. He was a 29-year-old invalid with no money, no family, no friends or connections, no university education, and no experience. Liberals, Jews, and communists ruled his country, making him and all those to whom he might appeal for support outsiders. 5½ years later, he was sentenced to 5 years in prison for his political activity, and his enemies thought that was the end of him and his movement. But less than 9 years after being sentenced, he was Chancellor of Germany, with the strongest and most progressive nation in Europe at his command. He had built the National Socialist Movement and led it to victory over the organized opposition of the entire establishment, conservatives, liberals, communists, Jews, and Christians. He then transformed Germany, lifting it out of its economic depression, while Americans, under Roosevelt, continued to line up at the soup kitchens, restoring its spirit and much of the territory which had been taken from it by the victors of the First World War, stimulating its artistic and scientific creativity, and winning the admiration, or in some cases, the envy and hatred of other nations. It was an achievement hardly paralleled in the history of the world. Even those who do not understand the real significance of his creation must concede that. And what was the real significance of Hitler's work? One of his most earnest admirers in India, Savitri Devi, has given us a poetic answer to that question. She wrote, quote, "In its essence, the National Socialist idea exceeds not only Germany in our times, but the Aryan race and mankind itself and any epoch. It ultimately expresses that mysterious and unfailing wisdom according to which nature lives and creates, the impersonal wisdom of the primeval forest and of the ocean depth and of the spheres in the dark fields of space. And it is Adolf Hitler's glory not merely to have gone back to that divine wisdom, stigmatizing man's silly infatuation for intellect, his childish pride in progress, and his criminal attempt to enslave nature, but to have made it the basis of a practical regeneration policy of worldwide scope precisely now in our overcrowded, over-civilized, and technically over-evolved world at the very end of the Dark Age." End quote. More prosaically, Hitler's work, in contrast to that of his contemporaries, was above politics, above economics, above nationalism. He had mobilized a powerful, modern state and placed it at the service of our race so that our race might become fit to serve as an agent of the life force. Perceptive and idealistic young men from every nation in Europe and from many nations outside Europe as well recognized this significance, and they flocked to serve him and to fight for his cause, even at the cost of censure and ostracism from their more parochial and narrow-minded countrymen. There was never before an elite fighting force to match the SS, which, by the end of the Second World War, had more non-Germans than Germans in it. The war, of course, is counted as Hitler's great failure, even as the proof of his lack of greatness by his detractors. It merely proves that he was a man, not a god, even if a divine will worked through him, and that he could not perform miracles. He could not defend himself forever, with the governments of nearly the whole world allied in a total war to pull him down and destroy his creation so that they and the interests they served could return to business as usual. Even so, he gave a far better account of himself than any of his adversaries. And what will count in the long run in determining Adolf Hitler's stature is not whether he lost or won the war, but whether it was he or his adversaries who were on the side of the life force, whether it was he or they who served the cause of truth and human progress. We only have to look around us today to know it was not they.
You're listening to Resolution Radio. ResolutionRDO.com.
Welcome to American Dissident Voices. I'm Kevin Alfred Strom. We added George Lincoln Rockwell's In Hoc Signo Vinces, In This Sign Conquer, to our nearly 30-year-long series of American Dissident Voices broadcasts. Today, we add powerful excerpts from several of Rockwell's works, as introduced and presented in the case of the first excerpt by Professor Robert S. Griffin in his masterful biography of National Alliance founder William Pierce, The Fame of a Dead Man's Deeds. Rockwell was a great influence on the thinking of Dr. Pierce. In many ways, Rockwell awakened Dr. Pierce to a realization of the great struggle for survival between Europeans and Jews, and to the eternal truths embodied in Adolf Hitler's National Socialism. And it may also be said that William Pierce added significantly to Hitler's and Rockwell's legacy in his political and philosophical writings, especially his cosmotheist works. A year before his death, a reporter asked George Lincoln Rockwell, "Do you believe all of this you preach?" Rockwell, slowly and in a low voice, replied, "This has cost me the most beautiful wife in the world, 7 kids, all my relatives. I was a commander in the Navy and a half year away from a pension. Certainly, I believe all of this." Rockwell summarized much of his creed in what he called the Five Laws. The Five Laws: biological integrity, territory, leadership, status, and motherhood. Biological integrity, said Rockwell, is the absolute, total, and uncompromising loyalty to one's own racial group, and absolute, uncompromising hatred for outsiders who intrude and threaten to mix their genes with those of the females of the group. According to this idea, nature creates breeds of animals, including various species of human beings, and protects the biological purity of these breeds as a means of maintaining and improving them. Nature accomplishes these ends in humans through two powerful instincts: love of one's own breed and hatred for outsiders. These two instincts are equally necessary. Love of one's own is incredibly powerful and good, but it can't and shouldn't stand alone. It needs to be complemented by a deadly hate of that which threatens what is loved. Indeed, hate has its place. The notion that love is good and hate is evil is just the party line of Jews, liberals, queers, halfwits, and cowards, wrote Rockwell. And then there is the law of territory. To illustrate this concept, Rockwell used the example of tiny tropical fish called swordtails, who will stake out a section of a tank and ferociously attack anything that intrudes into their space. Rockwell claimed that human beings are like these swordtails. It is in our nature to stake out territory for ourselves and our people. He said that in human affairs, this law takes the form of adherence to the concept of private property and to national identification and loyalty. The law of leadership, according to Rockwell, is leadership of the group being in the hands of the very best. In the animal kingdom, he asserts, even if it were possible, leaders would not be selected by democratic vote. Nature's method is combat, not the ballot, says Rockwell. Nature wouldn't employ a democratic vote because that is a chancy way of bringing the very best of the group to positions of leadership. Human affairs has demonstrated that in the long run, if not immediately, voting will inevitably result in something other than the best in leadership positions. Leaders chosen in democratic fashion are very likely to be the glibest and the slickest, but they are very unlikely to be the wisest and most capable. The law of status is similar to the law of leadership, except that it applies to all positions in the group and not just the leadership positions. The law of status says that for every individual, there is a natural slot in a hierarchical ordering of members of a group. All of the group members compete for their slot or niche in this hierarchy and then settle into it and are reasonably content with it. The result of this process, said Rockwell, is that things run peacefully for the group and in an orderly and efficient way. And then lastly, there is the law of motherhood. Rockwell asserted that it is nature's way that females stay out of the affairs of males and that they specialize in producing and rearing the young and creating healthy families. To Rockwell's way of thinking, we violate these five laws at our extreme peril, and that there is one group in particular that is doing its best to persuade us to do just that. The Jews. Rockwell tells us, the Jews have spread the unspeakably destructive idea of universalism, one worldism, one mob of raceless, stateless, and atomized individuals as the supreme idea of mankind. Even the conservatives have been suckered into paying lip service to this same unnatural, fragmented, super-individualistic Jewish disease of society. We are told by the Jews that the law of biological integrity, love inside, hate outside, is, quote-unquote, racism, the ultimate evil of all time. We are told that if we do not love yellow men, black men, and especially Jews, as much as our own people, then we are vicious, perverted, and doomed. We are racists. Millions of pitiful white suckers believe that Jewish lie. We are told that the law of territory, private property, is an unnatural greed, and that decent men must wish to share everything and have no desire for their own private property. They call this Marxist socialism, communism, and various other names indicating a concern for society and community. But all of them strike at the heart of the most powerful and only motivation in living creatures: to build, create, and produce. Millions believe these Jew liars. We are told by the Jews that the law of leadership, rule of the best, is dictatorship, and that we must strive for democracy, rule by mobs. Millions of white Aryans have been suckered into believing this siren song of democracy until mobs of human garbage are now terrorizing our whole nation. We are told by the Jews that the law of status, the establishment of the natural order of ability of each person in his right place, is class exploitation, and that the natural leaders of a society, those who have been successful, must be smashed and murdered by those who have not. Whole nations full of good white Aryans have been suckered with this vile Jewish method of dividing and conquering our people through class warfare. Finally, we are told by these ever-loving Jews that the specialization of women in child-rearing is a beastly enslavement of our females, that women are intended to be judges, locomotive engineers, army officers, and business executives. The result, of course, is the growing destruction of that sacred and beautiful institution of all healthy civilizations, motherhood, and with it, the home and the family. Our entire Western world has fallen for this democratic Jewish swindle, which has made women the most pitiful victims of the Jewish disease. Millions of modern women are hopelessly lost, frustrated, and utterly miserable, even while they are squawking about more rights through loudspeakers and marching around in hell-raising militant political organizations. Meanwhile, millions of families are without warm, wonderful mothers, and homes are becoming more like luxurious jails than the miracles of love and warmth that were the homes of a century before. Rockwell argues that the Jews themselves adhere to the law of the tribe at the same time that they push its violation on others. Rockwell writes, "The group loyalty of Jews is perhaps the most fantastic in the history of the world. It has propelled them into near mastery of the entire world. not because they are braver, work harder, are more intelligent, or more worthy than the rest of us, but because they observe the basic laws of nature and maintain group loyalty, while all the rest of us have fallen for their rotten, one world, we are all brothers garbage, which disintegrates our society. The Jews maintain their society with a group loyalty such as history has never before seen, and thus they go from one triumph to another. Rockwell would also write, "We believe that Adolf Hitler was the gift of an inscrutable providence to a world on the brink of Jewish Bolshevik catastrophe, and that only the blazing spirit of this heroic man can give us the strength and inspiration to rise from the depths of persecution and hatred to bring the world a new birth of radiant idealism, realistic peace, international order, and social justice for all men." I recalled the words of the leader, quote, "When human hearts break and human souls despair, then from the twilight of the past, the great conquerors of distress and care, of shame and misery, of spiritual slavery and physical compulsion, look down upon them and hold out their eternal hands to despairing mortals. Woe to the people that is ashamed to grasp them." Close quote. Slowly, bit by bit, I began to understand. I realized that National Socialism, the iconoclastic worldview of Adolf Hitler, was the doctrine of scientific racial idealism, actually a new religion for our time. No longer was Adolf Hitler only a great mind to me. Now I realized the inscrutable power of the human soul. Now I knew why the power of that human soul for 10,000 years, again and again, has conquered the mightiest aggregates of physical force and tyranny, regardless of odds or possibilities. I had run the full circle from savage and childish animal instinct, the primitive stage of most of humanity, to conceited and sterile intellectualism, the state of our convinced Marxists and liberals. And finally, I had, with the help of the great leader, found my way back to the natural understanding of the world given freely to every dog and worm and ape and man, of which the intellect is only a sort of recent development or trick. I had found my way to that unconscious understanding of eternal riddles which can only be called wisdom, the same perception of the essence of things which has, in different guises, formed the basis of the teachings of all great leaders in all times. As the emotional storm subsided within me, it left me filled with a holy sense of mission, which is the fundamental weapon and armor of a revolutionary leader. Where before I had wanted to fight the forces of tyranny and regression, now I had to fight them. But even more, I felt within me the power to prevail. Strength beyond my own strength, the ability to do the right thing, even when I was personally overwhelmed by events. and that strength has not yet failed me. Nor will it fail. It is the power beyond the atom, the force called religious by the non-intellectual, psychological self-hypnosis by the brains of today, and the unknowable by those who have learned true wisdom. I knew with calm certainty exactly what to do. And I knew in a hard-to-explain sense what was ahead. It was something like looking at a road from the air after seeing only the curve ahead from the ground. The world was obviously building up to an unheard-of, unprecedented clash between the dark forces of massed ignorance, greed, envy, hate, and stupidity, mustered and led by the scheming Jew, and the perishing forces of nature's elite, the white man. The Jew, with his Marxist democratic idea of the supremacy of mere numbers, threatened to overwhelm the white men of the world, regardless of boundaries or political affiliations, by the sheer mass of the teeming colored and inferior masses, which outnumbered the white builders of civilization by more than 7-1. Adolf Hitler had shown the way to survival. It would be my task on this earth to carry his ideas and his laboratory example to total worldwide victory. I knew that I would not live to see the victory, which I would make possible. But I would not die before I had made that victory certain.
You're listening to Resolution Radio.
ResolutionRDO.com.